How much money can a political party spend when that party is working alongside the candidate? Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. That is the question at hand in a case argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in December. The case will determine both the boundaries of the First Amendment and the influence of big money in the next presidential campaign. It's a complicated area of law, and the justices appeared divided during the arguments. So I sat down with University of Sioux Falls Professor Mike Thompson to get some clarity about the case.
Go back to the famous Citizens United case of 2010, where the Supreme Court said you have a First Amendment right, essentially, unions, corporations, to donate as much as you want to a political candidate.
That's speech.
Right.
Protected speech.
Protected speech. So okay. you can donate as much as you want. And that referred to individual contributions, like my contributions to a political party, a political candidate, a political committee. I can do that without limit. This one deals with this thing called party-coordinated communication. Okay. So there, Congress has limits on what a political committee can do to assist a political candidate. So there are spending limits on that. The Supreme Court, back in 2001, said that the same limits that are attacked in this present case said that those limits do not violate the First Amendment.
Okay.
So you've got a span of 24 years. 2001, Supreme Court says no First Amendment problem. Now it's being asked to revisit that decision, which gets us back to the stare decisis dilemma. And J.D. Vance is one of the named parties here for when he was running for Senate. And they argue that, well, circumstances have changed so much. The court's opinions on election financing and the First Amendment have changed so much that that Colorado decision is no longer good law.
Hmm.
So again, we're at a point where what's the Supreme Court going to do? Is it going to stand by this 2001 case? If they do, then it's done.
Yeah.
But
there's also this 1971 Federal Election Campaign Act. Does that come into play at all, or is that irrelevant now?
No, that comes into play. That these coordinated campaign expenditures are discussed in the Code of Federal Regulations. They're defined there, but no, that act is what we're talking about.
Okay.
There are a couple of other cases. One involved Ted Cruz for Senate back in 2021. He loaned $260,000 to his campaign committee, and he can be repaid from the campaign committee, but federal law limits the repayment amount to $250,000 with some very narrow exceptions. So Cruz sued, said that violated his First Amendment protection. Supreme Court agreed with him on that one. And the other one is the McCutcheon case from 2014. That one struck down a limit on aggregate amounts that a person can give over a two-year span to political committees, candidates, and political parties. Mm-hmm. So in those cases, those all deal with a person's contributions to another person. These are individual contributions.
Mm-hmm.
The coordinated ones are the committee or the party aligning with the candidate to push a certain issue.
So what's at stake here? A whole lot of money?
A whole lot of money. Because in 2001, the Supreme Court said, if we knock down these coordinated limits, coordinated communication limits, that's just going to be an end run around the other individual limits. Mm-hmm. Now, it might be that since Citizens United, in a different context, said you can give what you want, the First Amendment protects your ability to do that, it may be that the court says, you know, we said that in Citizens United, we're just going to make that a carte blanche thing.
Right. And what's at stake here is, or some people say, hey, if I have money, I have right to give it to the candidate that I want, as long as it's not a quid pro quo. You're giving me, you know, a vote, for example. I'm not buying votes, but I can give you an unlimited amount of money.
Yep.
And then other justices have said over time, the noise of the big donors drowns out
right.
the symphony of American voices.
Right.
And that's what's at stake here.
Yep, it is. Mm. It's an interesting case in First Amendment jurisprudence, I think. On the one side, the fact that the Supreme Court took it, when it would have been an easy out for them to say, either to not grant the writ of certiorari or to grant the writ and say, well, it's controlled by our 2001 case, we're not going to do it again. The fact that they're looking at it again, I think they're going to make a change on it.
Hmm. All right.
So we'll see. As usual.
As usual, we'll wait and see. Any decisions that have come out that you want to touch base on?
I do.
Yeah, tell me.
There are a couple. Clark versus Sweeney was decided on November 24 of 2025. Sort of a narrow issue. It's a post-conviction case where an inmate is suing his lawyer, claiming the lawyer was ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
They go to, and this is sort of a gatekeeping function that you'll probably like too. They go to court. The inmate loses on his ineffective assistance ground, but the court grants his petition for habeas corpus relief on a ground that the guy didn't raise. So the court has essentially looked at this and said, hey, I'm going to, on my own here, grant you relief, but not on the ground that you raised. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You got to do it either on the ground he raises or
you can't
not
help
at all.
That much.
Right. You cannot help that much. And the United States and the UK are about the only two criminal justice systems that are adversarial anymore, which means the judges are essentially referees. Mm. They're limited in what they can do on their own. They do only what the parties ask versus an inquisitorial system like Japan, and where the judges are active participants in the investigations and those kinds of things. So it goes to that. You cannot rule on something a party didn't raise. Pitts versus Mississippi is more significant than Clark versus Sweeney, and it's pretty significant from a Sixth Amendment standpoint. So Pitts, and this was decided on November 24, 2025, too. This deals with the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation. So the Sixth Amendment says, in a criminal prosecution, an accused has the right to confront the witnesses.
Okay.
General rule is that's face-to-face. Mm. If I'm a defendant in a criminal action, someone's going to testify against me. They have to sit across from me, and I'm able to look at them. They're able to look at me. It's supposed to help the truth-telling, the confrontation clause. So that's a general rule. It's got to be face-to-face. Supreme Court in the 80s dealt with the confrontation clause, especially in a case like Pitts, where it's a child sexual abuse case.
Sure.
The court has noted that children, that the government has a compelling interest in protecting children in those types of cases. So in this one, Mississippi has a statute that mandates the use of a screen between an alleged victim of child sex abuse and the defendant. So the defendant can't see the child can't see the defendant.
Yeah.
May or may not be a violation of the Confrontation Clause. But the problem with it is the Mississippi statute is mandatory. A trial judge has no discretion. If the prosecution requests a screen, the screen goes up. The Supreme Court said you might be able to use a screen, but you can't just do it on a generalized finding of necessity. You have to make case-specific findings as to the necessity of using the screen. So the Supreme Court sent that one back to the trial court saying, you might be able to use the screen, but you got to specifically tell us why the screen's necessary.
Yeah. One more?
One more.
From November?
Yeah, there was a case called Goldie versus Fields, which was decided. That's an Eighth Amendment case. The inmate alleged that he was subjected to excessive force. It's a federal claim, federal inmate. So the federal inmate isn't entitled to sue under 1983 because 1983 covers only state people acting under color of state law. So his only option is to sue under a case called Bivens. The Bivens case was used by the Supreme Court to create a remedy for a constitutional violation by a federal official.
Okay.
So 1983 covers constitutional deprivations made by state officials. Bivens was crafted to cover federal officials. The Supreme Court, since the time of Bivens in the 60s, has said, we're not going to extend Bivens to anything but new circumstances. So the court said that here, Bivens, this is a new circumstance, Eighth Amendment excessive force claim, but we're not going to extend it because there are other remedies available to the inmate. So, but and this gets into the excessive force by federal law enforcement, excessive force by state law enforcement, and all this talk about when those officers should be immune from those kinds of that kind of litigation.
So the consequences of the decision?
Bivens, so if my constitutional rights are taken from me by a federal official, only two ways I can get at that, either through a Bivens claim or the Federal Tort Claims Act. Mm-hmm. So this is an indication that Bivens is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and pretty soon it's not going to be available, which leaves me only with the Federal Tort Claims Act. The Federal Tort Claims Act provisions, the Federal Tort Claims Act is where the United States waives its immunity and allows lawsuits against it.
Right.
But the Federal Tort Claims Act also has a number of exceptions where the United States says, well, wait a minute, in these situations we're hanging on to our immunity. And one of those exceptions is excessive force by federal officials.
So what protects an American citizen from excessive force by a federal official?
The Federal Tort Claims Act and Bivens to a certain extent.
But the federal government can say
the
no.
Well, in the Federal Tort Claims Act, so the federal government, general rule, they can't be sued.
Right.
Governments can't be sued. They got sovereign immunity. The United States, however, through the statute, says, okay, you can sue us under these circumstances. The exceptions to the waiver, which means these are times when the United States says, you know, just wait a minute, you can't sue us for these things. One is called the discretionary function exception. So if the federal officer's actions were discretionary, the United States can't be sued for that. So making an arrest is a discretionary function. Prosecution is a discretionary function. Investigations are discretionary functions. So there are lots of instances where if the action is discretionary, the United States can't be sued. There's a separate exception that says the United States can't be sued for certain torts, like malicious prosecution, false arrest, force claims, unless the perpetrator is a federal law enforcement or investigative officer. So the Federal Tort Claims Act will allow me to sue the officer if the officer commits one of the listed torts, but I still got to get past the discretionary function exception. So the argument always is, if I commit a false arrest, that has an element of intent in it, which would seem to say that an intentionally wrongful act can't be discretionary. So sometimes you're able to avoid the discretionary function depending on the facts of the tort. But it's hard.
If you are detained and arrested by a federal ICE agent and you're a U.S. citizen and they locked you up or treated you poorly in the process of it, what is your recourse?
Sue the United States under the Federal Tort Claims Act, and the United States will have to prove that the decision to arrest me was a discretionary function.
Thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
That's Mike Thompson. He's a professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. You can find all his legal analysis on our website at sdpb.org. And that's our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.